Good morning. You are listening to WYSO in Yellow Springs. I'm Vic McCunis. Coming up in the Book Nook this morning, we'll have a guest in studio coming in from Columbus. Her name is Julia Keller, and her new crime novel, part of a series, features a prosecutor named Belle Elkins who lives in West Virginia. There's a mysterious murder, and Belle is trying to prosecute the supposed perpetrator. We'll find out how it turns out, sort of, coming up in the Book Nook following NPR News right here on WYSO. Hello, welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and I'd like to welcome to the studio today Julia Keller. Her latest novel is Last Ragged Breath. Hello, Julia.
Good morning.
Julia, this is very much a West Virginia crime novel. How did you get into this? I know you've done a lot of things in your life. What made you decide to start writing a series of crime novels?
You know, I've always wanted to write fiction. You know, I had a long career in journalism. And people said to me, you know, why did you end that and start writing fiction? The truth is, fiction always was the thing I most wanted to do. So, and the idea of writing a mystery novel, a crime novel, was always lurking there as well. And as a kid, I was the one, of course, that read all the crime novels, all the mysteries, Nancy Drew, Hardy Boys, all the series. And I loved the crime series where all the spines were lined up there on the shelf with the identical spines, with the great titles. I wrote my own series when I was in fourth grade. The hero was a guy named Christopher Lee Carson. I was into three names back then. And the titles were things like The Clue of the Card Tip, The Clue of the Caller's Whistle, very influenced by the Nancy Drew titles, obviously. But it's what's always intrigued me as having written some true crime during my journalism career is that with crime stories, the big issues of life are writ large. It's a sort of a crucible in which all the really big issues that we deal with in our life are kind of gathered together. Life and death, punishment, judgment, retribution, innocence, guilt. All of the really big issues are right there. And it's a place where you can explore those, but you can also do it in an entertaining sense. So it doesn't have that kind of chilliness of pronouncement or of lecturing. You can do it as an entertaining story, but you're also dealing with some of the biggest issues of life.
Was the Christopher Lee an homage to the British horror film star?
You know, I never thought of that. I think you're a bit of a psychiatrist here, because come to think of it, of course, I love those as well, and Vincent Price too. The other day on Turner Classic Movies, they had the Vincent Price movie, The Last Man on Earth, which is possibly the single movie that haunted my dreams more than any other. I saw it as a kid down at the local. There's a theater where you pay a quarter and walk in and you could sit there all day and see something about 14 times. And I often did that during my misspent youth.
I was haunted by the fly.
Feed me. I'm hungry.
My guest is Julia Keller. Her book is Last Ragged Breath. You're from West Virginia, is that right?
I am indeed. Born and raised in Huntington, which a lot of your listeners will know. It's the home of Marshall University, where my father taught mathematics for many years. So West Virginia was very much my home.
Does that make you a college brat?
Oh, I suppose so. In terms of, yeah, I like that analogy to being an Army brat. Yes, there is something special about being a faculty kid. I think there really is. You know, I have those memories of going with my father. In those days, he picked up his paycheck once a week at Old Main, which is still there at Marshall, on the Marshall campus. And so we'd go with him, and he'd get his paycheck, then put it in the 20th Street Bank, and they'd always give the kids, you know, a little dum-dum sucker. So that was clearly the high point for me.
Your protagonist in this book, and from what I understand in your previous crime novels, is a prosecutor. Now, what made you decide to take it from that angle?
You know, that's a great question, because to me, I read a lot of crime fiction. It's something I really enjoy, and also think of some of our great literature now is being written in the crime fiction genre. But I didn't read a lot about prosecutors. There are a lot of defense attorneys, you know, who take these sort of last-ditch cases. There are a lot of crusading private investigators, you know, the great PIs and the Raymond Chandler series, and those we all know. But very, very, very few prosecutors. In fact, off the top of my head, I couldn't think of any at all. And I wanted to come at it from that angle because what I wanted to do was explore in West Virginia, of course, the real life tragedy right now unfolding is the prescription drug epidemic. It has completely transformed my hometown and many Appalachian hometowns. But to tell this story, it's been told a lot through the victims. It's been told a lot through the perpetrators of the crimes. But I'd not seen a lot done through the eyes of the prosecutor, the people who are charged with trying to rid this beautiful, beautiful area of an epidemic that is absolutely destroying it.
Well, that epidemic is widespread, and it seems to be morphing into a heroin epidemic.
Yes, indeed. I discussed that in some of the earlier books as well, that as of course, pills are quite expensive. Prescription drug pills are quite expensive, things like oxycodone. But heroin is cheap, and that, of course, as I say in the book, creates an auxiliary misery, a whole new spiral of addiction and tragedy back in these very impoverished places that certainly didn't need one more problem.
Your prosecutor is named Bell Elkins, and you've got a blurb on the front of the book from someone who's been on this program. He says, Bell Elkins is one of the most fully realized characters in fiction today. High praise from Michael Connelly.
Indeed, indeed. Yes, one of my very favorites, and I think one of the preeminent storytellers of our time. Also a former journalist.
Former reporter. Uh-huh.
Yes, yes, on the crime beat for many years. I should say, too, that Bell's real name is Belfa. Bell is a nickname. Belfa is my great aunt's name, and almost no one has heard of it. And whenever I do, you know, I speak or read from the books, people are, Belfa, Bell. They confuse it with Belva. And other names that they've heard. And in fact, so I asked my great aunt, she's 93 now, and I said, so the name Belfa, where did your parents get it? And she says, as far as I know, they made it up. She'd never heard of it either. So if any of your listeners know of another Belfa, let me know. But it is an unusual name, but her nickname as well has been Bell.
I've never heard the name. So tell us about Belfa. What's her story? Apparently she's had a difficult life.
Yes, very much so. Had a very difficult childhood, an abusive father, an absent mother. She and her sister were raised in a ramshackle trailer until the night when her older sister Shirley killed their father as he was coming after Bell to continue his abusive ways. And so Shirley serves a long prison sentence because of that. Bell is raised in foster care. She gets married, marries a fellow person from Rathoon County, which is fictional, and Acres Gap, which is a county seat. He has a law degree. They go away to Washington, D.C. He has a very lucrative career as an attorney and then a lobbyist. Bell herself is restless. She's at home, stay-at-home mom with a small child, goes to Georgetown Law School, and then discovers that there is something missing in her life and decides she wants to return to her hometown and see what she can do on behalf of the citizens who she knows have really fallen on very bleak, hard times. Her husband says, if you go back, you'll be going back alone. So they're divorced. She returns to Acres Gap with her 10-year-old daughter in tow, and her adventures begin.
I think she just wanted to go back to that beautiful old courthouse.
Yes. You know, I was having trouble when I originally envisioned the courthouse, and I had to – what I generally do is I'll go back to West Virginia when I need to, and I'll go back to drive around and to kind of remind myself and refresh my imagination. I walk through a lot of cemeteries. I loved being kind of bathed in the names at cemeteries. I love old cemeteries. And with the courthouse, I was having trouble, and so I went back, and I love county courthouses. They're one of the great examples of architecture in this country. Indiana, West Virginia, and Ohio, I think three states that have some of the most beautiful county courthouses you'll ever find.
We had Ed McBain in studio for an interview on September 10th, 2001. And Ed said, you know, when you're writing a crime novel, he says, the first thing you've got to have is a corpse. and as we start your book, for those of us that know about dogs, I don't think it's a spoiler to say you've got a dog who's really getting excited. And for those of us who know this canine behavior, we can guess why.
Yes. Yes, indeed. In fact, you know, I was driving along one day and I saw at the side of the road something looked like kind of something undulating and moving. I didn't know what it was. And I could tell from the outset that it was a deer carcass. And I thought, by the side of the road, what in the world was that? And then as I got closer, this up pops this dog's head, and he is just absolutely thrilled. You know, he's covered with writhing intestines, and he's got this look on his face that is absolute unbridled joy, like, I have hit the mother lode. And I thought, that's dogs. I mean, they make no bones about it, by golly. I mean, this is found beauty here.
Well, I think eventually they make bones.
Yeah, very true. But I think that's something that's so wonderful about animals. You know, we're always trying to kind of hide what we really are. I think of that sometimes. We even have little doilies that go over the, you know, the extra roll of toilet paper. You go in people's homes, and it's fine. I mean, these are lovely people. But the fact that we take a little crochet doily and we put it over the extra roll of toilet paper, somehow we want to keep the reality of life, some of what we think of as some of its less savory aspects, off to one side. But that's what I love about animals. It's like, no, this is what I am.
Julia Keller joins us in studio. Her new novel is Last Ragged Breath. Okay, Ed would be happy wherever he is. You start off with this body. It's in the river. Is that too much to say?
No. Okay. We're right at the edge here of not, okay. You know, I was never alert. I never cared very much about spoiler alerts until I began to write.
Okay.
And now I'm like,
This is like page 3. So.
Okay, all right.
But I'm leery about going much further with this other than to say that we end up having a murder trial.
Yes.
And Belle is the prosecutor prosecuting this guy who has been damaged, like she has been damaged, but in a very different way. Now, you're talking about a historical disaster here. Do you
yes.
want to talk about that?
Yes. Yes, indeed.
Okay.
In 1972, on February 26th, there was an event called, now known as the Buffalo Creek Disaster. It was when a slag dam that the coal company had built up over years and years and years. This is the waste material, the refuse from coal mines, had just gotten bigger and bigger and bigger. And the coal company had been warned repeatedly, it's not a good idea. This is a very narrow valley. And they kind of shrugged it off, as corporations are sometimes want to do. Then came a heavy rain on a Friday night, and on Saturday morning, the dam burst. As I mentioned, it happened in 1972. I was a kid. But when you live in West Virginia, you're kind of I always maintain that you live very close to some of these tragedies. The Marshall plane crash, some of your listeners are familiar with, I'm sure, and the Buffalo Creek disaster. Those were the two really seminal disasters of my childhood. 125 people were killed immediately. 4,000 people left homeless, all up and down the age range. And many of the people were completely unidentifiable. They had the bodies laid out at Mann High School, the local high school, on the gym. It was very hard to identify the bodies. They were all covered with this black sludge that a slag dam is comprised of. Just a horrifying tragedy. And, of course, the aftermath made it even worse. The coal company refused responsibility. There was long litigation. And the survivors, including some children, and that's the man in my story that you mentioned, he was 2 years old at the time of the disaster, were really not compensated in ways they should have been. I mean, I think of what would happen now in 2015. It would be very different. But this was 1972. This was West Virginia. And there was this idea in the air, not spoken, but certainly palpable, that these lives weren't worth very much. These were coal miners, coal miners' children, coal miners' wives, coal miners' grandmothers and grandfathers. These are people who lived in trailers, who didn't have a lot. And it really was the kind of tragedy. I think in many ways the aftermath of Katrina proved this too, that told us more culturally about the ways that we treat certain groups of people in this country, told us more than we want to know sometimes.
You're listening to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis. We'll continue our conversation with Julia Keller right after this. The Book Nook continues on WYSO, and it's my absolute pleasure to have Julia Keller in the studio with me today. We're talking about her new novel, Last Ragged Breath. You're just talking about social economic sort of issue with these people who were killed in this disaster. You have a lot of these themes in your book. And in West Virginia, we have a coal mining culture that has basically collapsed like
yes.
an old mine shaft.
Yeah.
And apparently there's some development going on there. That's one of the themes in your story is a big developer has come into the area and wants to
Yeah.
create jobs, right?
Yes, indeed. Well, in a place like the Greenbrier you think of, which is a well-known resort. And Bell's attitude is fine, but the kinds of jobs you're talking about. I mean, coal mining, for all of its terribleness, and there's absolutely no doubt, of course, what fossil fuels have done to our world, what they continue to do, and the lives of coal miners. But as a character in Last Ragged Breath says, there's only one thing worse than a job in a coal mine, and that's not having a job in a coal mine. When these jobs go, I mean, these were very high-paying jobs, and West Virginia right now is at such a crossroads where they're going to have to decide what's going to replace those very high-paying jobs. jobs at fast food restaurants are not going to do it. You don't raise a family on that. And that's Belle's concern about this new resort coming in the book, a fictional resort called Mountain Magic. And as she says to one of her friends there who's touting the economic benefits of this, she goes, really? So bellhops and maids and fry cooks, those jobs are not the same as what coal mining jobs were. So what's going to replace those incomes? And that's always been the question in places like West Virginia, which are very isolated, and there isn't a lot of educational opportunity. What do you do? I mean, what do you do to earn a living? You have this great surpassing beauty in these places, but what do you do to earn a living? And that's one of the things I explore actually in all of the books in the series. This is the fourth one, is that sometimes terrible reckoning that people have to come to in their lives. What do they do?
In the previous book, was the sheriff still the same guy who has recently left the sheriff's
office?
Yes,
okay. Yes. Nick Fogelsong, who was her great confidant. He was certainly the hero of her childhood. She's known him since she first went into foster care. He was, at that point, a deputy. He came to the trailer the night it was burning, the night her sister burned down the trailer after killing their father.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Oh, my.
Yes, and he has this vivid memory of this 10-year-old girl standing there in the light of those flames and slipping her hand into his. And I'm sure if you've been around small children, you know they will do that. You know, when you're a small child, any adult who comes and is the least bit kind to you, you gravitate to, you kind of latch onto, and that's what he has, that memory of that small hand coming into his. And then he, in effect, shepherds her through the foster care years, and then she goes away to West Virginia Wesleyan and then begins to make her life. So her return is very much a reunion as well with Nick Fogelsong. And as you mentioned, Last Ragged Breath, things are very altered now in their relationship.
You have retold that story in one of the previous books about being a little girl.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
That adds a whole different layer to my sense of their connection.
Yeah, well, you need to read. I'll send you A Killing in the Hills. That was the first one. But, you know, you raise a good point there with a series. And, again, I love the idea of a series, and I read them. I love the Michael Conley, Harry Bosch series, all the great detective series. But the problem is sometimes repetition and then, you know, where are people coming into the story? I mean, each novel can stand alone, but there are things that do get kind of left behind that you wish that readers of this could know. So in a way, though, and I used to be a little bit disturbed about that, but now I think it's sort of like when you meet someone. You know, you don't know right away what their backstory is. You kind of learn it as you go. I mean, it would be kind of dreadful to meet someone. The first thing they do is kind of do an information dump and tell you everything. Part of the beauty of getting to know someone is just the way it's kind of like a river. I mean, it kind of flows in and out. You learn things as you go along. And I'm sure you've had this experience talking to a friend and suddenly they'll mention that, oh, I don't know, you know, they lived in Montana for a year or something. And you're going, Montana? Really? I mean, you find out some piece of information about them that is surprising and very special because you didn't know it originally.
I find that crime novels in series, some of them I would suggest you start at the beginning, and others I think it's fine to just read them completely out of order. I don't think it makes any difference.
Absolutely true. You know, I started the Sue Grafton ones kind of in the middle, and now I've gone back and I began. I actually like some of the earlier ones. I think probably A is for Alibi, B is for Burglar, C is for Corpse. Some of those early ones I really like. Now, they're very dated. You know, you don't have cell phones, and you can make the sort of technological, anachronisms. You can point those out all over the place. But there is a kind of a richness to coming upon them new and then kind of catching up with yourself. So that one I think you can kind of read out of order, even though things do change in our life. Of course they do. And the same with Belle. There are changes that occur as you go along, but when you go back and pick them up again, said I kind of like that sweep and surprise.
I love that 1980s thing that Sue does because there are no cell phones.
Yeah.
I love that. We had her on for W is for Wasted, and we're hoping to have her back for X, mm-hmm. the new book. She is just...
Oh, and that character.
So wonderful.
That character. I can never get enough of that character of Kinsey. I just she's just one of those characters that you open the book and you just feel like, okay, here I am. Again, not that she's easy. You're going to be the great best friend who's always going to send you the birthday card. But Kinsey Millhone is a character that you always want to know what she's thinking.
And in that last book, I don't know if you read W is for Wasted, but Kinsey has always resisted getting a cat.
Yeah.
And Sue Grafton figured out a way to get her a cat that she didn't have to worry about taking care of the cat.
Yeah.
And in your story, we have something that just brought tears to my eyes, and that's the connection between a Belle and a dog.
Yes, yes. I wanted her to be the kind of person, right, a dog would be strain the outermost limits of her ability to put up with. A cat, completely off the charts. There are those people that just aren't animal-oriented, and then there are people that are. And you can't ever tell. It has nothing to do with, you know, empathy or being a good person or anything like that. There are just some of us who just aren't built that way. But the dog idea came about because I wanted Royce Dillard, who's the man who at 2 years old was in the Buffalo Creek flood. I wanted something to suggest. I mean, we all live with some kind of connection. He can't make human connections for the reasons that I outline in the book, but he can make these connections with another living creature. And I know that I've known a very few people in my life that do have some of these characteristics that he exhibits, which is that inability to connect with others, but they have something. It can be something as small as a turtle or a parakeet or a cat or a dog, but some other living creature that requires something of them. That's very much it's the taking care of the dog. You know, I didn't realize that. My mother, my mother has had some health problems, and her old dog is a very old guy. He recently passed away. And the thing that I missed was, and she wanted to get a new dog, and I said, no, it's going to be too hard. It's the taking care of. That's what I had completely missed. I was in the midst of writing this novel, and I realized that's it. The dog, people go on about companionship. Yes, it is all that, but it's that taking care of. It's that being responsible for another person. That's part of the lure.
You have a special dog in your life, don't you?
I do indeed. I was hoping you'd bring up Edward. Yes, I was at actually in Crawford County, Ohio, where I was, which is not where I live, but I was traveling with some friends. They were up looking for a cat, wouldn't you know it, a cat. And I walked in, and there are all these dogs yapping in cages. I recently lost two dogs that were completely beloved to me, and I thought, I really just don't want – I just didn't think I could go through that again. You know, I love Thomas Lynch, the poet and writer. He says, grief is the tax we pay on our attachments, and I had just paid enough. I mean, it was such heartbreak to lose these two dogs. That was about 6 or 8 months ago, and I thought, okay, not going to do it. But I walk in, and there's this little black dog, clearly a mutt. He's got a little white crest on his chest, so I like to say that he's all black except for this. I like to say he's part lab, part superhero. But the truth is he's part everything you can imagine. So I walk in, I see this dog, and he just looks at me. And I swear to you, there was some kind of a psychic connection there because all the other dogs were kind of going crazy, jumping up and down and all this. And he was just looking at me like, I see. Well, this is a bit unseemly, but even when they let him out of the cage, I mean, he was clearly not ill. I mean, my parents used to always say, don't pick a dog who's quiet. That means he's sick. You know, they always said that was one of their little truisms, but no, not a bit of it. He's just a very contemplative sort of dog. He's got other things on his mind.
Julia Keller joins us. Her book is Last Ragged Breath. Have you ever been inside a coal mine?
I have. When I was a reporter, actually, I began my career at the Columbus Dispatch, Columbus, Ohio. I was sent down to Southern Ohio, and we went down into a working coal mine. One of my good friends is actually a National Public Radio correspondent, Howard Berkus, who covers the West. And he tells me nowadays that it's impossible for a reporter to get down into an underground coal mine. They just don't allow it for all kinds of reasons. But this was would have been early 90s. And down we went and picked in the coveralls and the hard hat. And it was probably one of the most frightening and yet one of the most beautiful, entrancing things I've ever done. When you get down into a coal mine, it's like nowhere else. You are under the earth, but for somehow you feel like you're out in space somewhere. There's a special smell. There's a special feel. And as long as you don't fasten your mind upon where you actually are, the fact that there are, you know, thousands upon thousands upon thousands of tons of rock over your head that could collapse at any moment, you do okay. And you have to bend over just a little slightly. I can't imagine. I mean, I'm not that tall. I'm about 5'4", but I can't imagine, like, for a 6-foot man, I'm sure the crick in the neck would be quite pronounced for the rest of his life. But yes, it was very important to me to have been down in a coal mine if I was going to write a book of this sort, because there is a scene in a coal mine, as you know. And that's important. I don't think, you know, it's not a George Plimpton kind of thing where you have to go somewhere to be able to write about it. I think some ways imagination is a far better travel companion than anything else. But in this case, I felt it was important to be down there.
So you didn't have to be a NFL player to qualify that way.
Right, or to commit a murder, right?
Right.
To write about a murderer.
Yeah, I had a chance to interview George Plimpton.
Oh.
But it didn't work.
Oh, because he's one, I think, just a really great, great hero of both journalism, nonfiction, yeah. And, of course, you know, the Paris Review, founding the Paris Review.
Yeah. You talked about going in a coal mine. They could have never got me to do that. I would have been terrified. I would have had vertigo in reverse. It just would not have worked.
Reverse vertigo.
Yes. Julia, do you want to give them just a broad thing about what the storyline is about without doing any spoilers? I'm going to leave that to you.
Yeah, you know, in this book, I wanted to explore a different issue in each book. And in this book particularly, I wanted to explore an issue of social justice. As I mentioned, in the aftermath of the Buffalo Creek disaster, the people were not very well compensated. The corporations were able to, you know, sort of pay a little money, almost like kind of flinging some money at a homeless person and then moving on. And that's always really bothered me, and particularly now that corporations are, we know, and politically in the light of the Citizens United decision, corporations say, we're like people. Treat us like people. We should be able to make political contributions. And what my character, Royce Dillard, says, well, hang on here. You're saying I killed somebody. Can I just pay some money and get out of it? And we allow corporations to. If they want to be people, then someone should have gone to jail. Someone should have had to pay the price for that. The corporation should be held at that level. After the Buffalo Creek disaster, Royce Dillard's point is, why didn't anyone go to jail? Why wasn't anyone charged with murder? Because it was murder. So it's that kind of hypocrisy in our culture that I wanted to explore. That was sort of the large overarching theme. And of course, the great thing about novels and literature is that you can take the overarching theme that deals with a topical issue, something that we're all wrestling with as citizens of this country, and you can bring it down to the specific level of a story. And that's kind of carries a reader along. So again, so they don't feel they're being lectured at or preached at all. The idea of a story is you want to keep turning those pages. And that's what happens in the course of this story. There is a death. Royce Dillard's on trial for it. But that's what he keeps asking himself and the reader. Why would I need to pay for a murder, assuming I committed it, when the directors of this coal company, the board of directors, the managers, all walked away?
And Belle is one of these classic workaholic types who never stops working. She never stops thinking about her job. And she tries to have a social life. There's a fellow who's very nice, who's interested in her. And yet, apparently there's somebody in a previous book that she just can't get over.
Yes, and he's much younger than her. And she knows what everybody's going to be saying. They're going to be talking about, you know, Dustin Hoffman and Anne Bancroft and The Graduate. She knows cougar. She knows all those words. And she sort of comes to the point when, like, well, so what? This is what I want. She doesn't really care that much about the opinions of others, but on this issue, her family, her romantic issue, she does a bit. And you're quite right. She is a kind of a do-gooder. She's a white knight kind of person. She's on the horse, you know, tilting at the windmills. I'm not that sort of person, but I work with many people in the course of my journalism career that certainly were, and they really believed that with enough hard work and perseverance and fighting the good fight, you really can make changes in the world. I'm a bit more cynical than that. But Belle is that delightful combination of the cynicism and the idealism that makes for a better world, I think, but makes it very hard for the individual who's living that life.
I read a lot of crime novels, and I always look for those peripheral characters who I really like, who end up being important parts of the story. And you've got a couple in this one, and one is the deputy, this Oakes guy, and the other one is the assistant prosecutor. I love those characters.
Yes, and they're even more foregrounded in previous books, and actually in the one that I'm writing now, which will come out next year, Rhonda plays a larger role as well. They kind of come and go in the way in our lives. In some of the previous books, they have a little larger role and a little less one here because with Royce Dillard kind of occupying the spotlight. Serena Crumpler, who is his defense attorney, also is in a previous book. I mean, this is a small town. So you see the people, you'd weave in and out of other people's stories all the time. The librarian comes back in the next books as well. Sally McArdle, who has lost a leg to her diabetes. These are people that you see in and out throughout the stories. I had a dream once of returning to my town in West Virginia. I was going to, like, run for governor and change the world, all that, the bit of the Belle in me. But I have to say, someone asked me why I didn't return to Huntington, and I said, you know, in a way, it's a small town, but the streets would be too crowded for me, by which I meant all the ghosts. You know, a previous book, Bitter River, I dedicated to the ghosts of home, because that phrase just stayed with me. There's something about having them right at your elbow, all the people who are here no longer, you know, all the days that are gone, that I found quite devastating at times. I can write about it and have the distance there, but it's difficult at times to be around what the past was. I mean, my father died quite young. As I mentioned, he taught at Marshall. He was a very special person in my life. And when he died, I had that feeling of kind of moving on then from West Virginia. He was very much a son of Appalachia.
You're listening to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm in conversation with Julia Keller. Her new novel, Last Ragged Breath, just came out, published by Minotaur Books. In fact, it just was officially published yesterday as we're recording this, and she's out on book tour right now. We'll continue with the Book Nook right after this. We continue with the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and Julia Keller is here in studio with me today, talking about her novel, Last Ragged Breath. It's a crime novel, part of her series featuring the prosecutor Belle Elkins, set in West Virginia. And you actually have someone in the story. You mentioned this person who's actually been on this program.
Really?
Yeah. I always look for that.
Who would that be?
Studs Terkel.
Oh, of course. Okay, because I started thinking, I mentioned a couple of movies in there too, and I'm thinking, one of my favorite movies is A Year of Living Dangerously with Mel Gibson and Sigourney Weaver. And I thought, you had Mel Gibson on this program? But
oh, that would have been fun.
It would have been. You would have taken him apart.
Actually, I'll take Studs Terkel.
Absolutely. I'm with you on that.
You had a long career in Chicago. Did you ever know Studs?
You know, I met him a couple of times. A good friend of mine, Elizabeth Taylor, the books editor for a time at the Tribune, now editor at large, was a good friend of his and would visit him quite regularly. Think about an American treasure. I mean, there you go. It's just, and he was just as wonderful as you would expect. You know that old line about not meeting your heroes? Sometimes I was a little afraid the first time when I was going to go meet him. I thought, oh, what if he's like a fraud? You know, what if he's not really this guy? Because, of course, we'd all read Working, and we all, you know those wonderful books. But no, he is as he lived. In some ways, he reminds me of Jimmy Carter, former President Carter. It's that same thing, where they are what they seem to be. And very few of us are. I mean, that's a tough thing to pull off when you're in public life. I mean, I think it's easier to have that kind of continuity when you're a private person. But when you're in public life, how do you keep from kind of being more than you actually are, trying to come across that way, sort of puffed up and grandiose? And so you met him, you had him on the show?
We had him on the show. That was a phone interview, but I have met him too. In fact, Jimmy Carter was supposed to be on the program. And, you know, he's put out a lot of books over the years.
Yes.
And it got to the point where the Secret Service was checking me out. He was on book tour. He was coming to Dayton. Then at the last minute, he heard about a corrupt election in, I think, Nigeria or somewhere. And he had to cancel his book tour and go.
Wow.
Yeah. And it's like, I missed my chance. I really regret that. But you compare Studs and Jimmy. I see similarities for sure. But I actually was at Studs' house one time.
Mm-hmm.
We'd picked him up at the airport, and we were taking him home, and he says, why don't you come in for a snort? And we went in there, and he made me a martini. And I couldn't picture Jimmy Carter doing that.
Yeah, well,
maybe a Billy beer, but...
you're right. You're right. Very true.
He was all out of gin, so he had to use Stoli's.
Yeah, that's wonderful. I told a story once about E.L. Doctorow making me a turkey sandwich. And I mean, it's one of the things you just remember. I mean, that I love that juxtaposition of these people whose work we admire so inordinately, and yet they are indeed just human beings walking the earth, which we know. Of course, we know that intellectually. But it's so nice to see in a way, because I think in a way it sort of enlarges everybody's sense of possibility. It means that anyone really can be capable of these things. Anyone can be better than they are. And when you see these great people we admire in their daily life and their dailiness, and see that dailiness is there as well, it does give hope for anybody, I think. I mean, I kind of see it then going in the other direction. And, of course, the opposite's true, too. I mean, I know you talk to a lot of people who, and I certainly did a lot of interviews with people I probably shouldn't name names, but, I mean, they talk about disappointing. You know, I mean, it's really disenchanting to meet someone who you admire and discover that, wow, they're rude to their staff, they're rude to people that it's not necessary to be rude to.
Well, Julia, I hate to be a nitpicker, but I did read your obituary for E.L. Doctorow that you had in the Chicago Tribune, and I think it was a ham sandwich.
Oh, okay. Wow. This guy, man, you sound like some of my editors. You're right.
Well, you know, I don't work for the New Yorker, but, you know, we do have to fact check all these things. And Did it have mayonnaise
Great
on it?
Great point. Or, you know, it's funny. He asked me about mayonnaise, and I happen to despise mayonnaise. It's the one thing. So I said, no, 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 mustard. And actually, he approved of that. He approved of that.
E.L. Doctorow had been named the recipient of an award or an honor from
the Chicago Tribune. And I would, that was my great privilege there. I would go interview all these people. I flew to Toronto and interviewed Margaret Atwood.
Oh, wow.
David McCullough, who I know you recently talked about. I went to his home in Maine. And it's so, you just pull up in your little rental car, you know, your cars, you hear your tires on the gravel, and you stop and you knock on the door, and he opens the door, and it's like, hello, Mr. McCullough, I'm Julia Keller, how are you? And you sit down with a glass of iced tea and have a real conversation. That was one of the great privileges of being the literary critic there at the Tribune. And E.L. Doctorow, too, as you mentioned. I went to interview him at his home in Long Island.
I love that obituary because there was such a powerful emotional resonance that you keyed in on his days in college at Kenyon.
Yes.
And how he was there with, was it Richard Wright?
James Wright, the poet.
And they had this little inside joke. Do you want to share that?
Yeah, where they made fun of the poets on campus. Here they were, these young guys. You know, they were nobodies from nowhere, but they thought of themselves as they were the writers on campus. And they loved to make fun of the kind of bad poets on campus. So they would walk around the campus kicking at the leaves, going, the leaves are falling, the leaves are falling. You know, people like bad haiku. And at the very end of his life, James Wright, who had terrible struggles with alcoholism, E.L. Doctorow, and he told me the story in his kitchen, goes to see him. And he was not able to speak anymore. He had esophageal cancer. And his wife, James Wright's wife, handed him a ledger. And he wrote, here he is, hours from death, he wrote to his old friend, Ed Doctorow. He writes, the leaves are falling. On the ledger. And it gave me goosebumps at the time and still does now. It really, he kept up with people like that. I think Doctorow, for all of his acclaim, felt a little overlooked. And again, that's just you psychoanalyzed me in the first minutes of this interview, so I'll psychoanalyze him now. He did. I think he was really one of our preeminent literary artists. I think we were just going to have to live our way longer into understanding his achievement, not only in things like Ragtime, but I think books like City of God, and the great, great books, The March, his book about Sherman's March. And
I think the later books were ignored. I love the book about the hoarders.
Yes, yes, Homer and Langley.
I always wanted to know about them.
I think I wrote the only positive review of that. I know that it you know, I hurt as if it were my own work when I read the New York Times review of that book. I think it was completely misunderstood. And more than misunderstood, it was ridiculed. Ridiculing the work of an artist is the easiest thing in the world. I mean, there's nothing wrong with a bad review. You can not like something all day long. I have no problem with that, no quarrel with it. But you take it seriously. And E.L. Doctorow had earned the right to be taken more seriously than that. And again, I always need to make it clear. Critics can write what they feel and what they believe and their engagement with the book. That's what they write. But you don't ridicule. And I felt that certain reviews of that book completely missed the point of what he was doing, wished he had written another book, wondered why he had written this book at all. And I just thought he deserved much better as one of our great artists. I mean, I would rank him. I mean, to me, he leaves Philip Roth in the dust. He leaves John Updike in the dust. E.L. Doctorow's achievement will be one we will be talking about 100 years from now, 200 years from now.
They did ignore the last four or five books.
They did.
It was really sad. My guest is Julia Keller. Her book is Last Ragged Breath.
Which you should not ignore, right?
You know, I've had another former reporter on this program who won a Pulitzer while working for a newspaper, some guy named John Sanford.
Oh.
And I used to do so many interviews in here. I had him on the show, and I said, gosh, John, at the end of the interview, I said, you know, it's really great to meet you, finally. And he goes, what do you mean? He says, I was here 2 years ago. I was like, oops.
And yet you got me on that turkey ham sandwich thing.
Well, you know, it was kind of a blur, and sometimes you'd forget, and I can't make an excuse. He got me. It happens. So you won a Pulitzer Prize. I hear it was about a tornado.
Yes, a tornado hit a small town a little bit west of Chicago called Utica, Illinois. We had done the news story, of course, the next day news story, because there were multiple fatalities and the town was virtually destroyed. And that, about a month after that, maybe 3 weeks after that, my editor came to me and said, yeah, I think there might be more to that story. And I'm going, oh, come on, what more? I mean, I was absolutely resistant to the idea. But he said, just go get bang around. I had one of those great editors who'd say, just go knock around a little bit, talk to some people, see what you think. He had more faith in me than I did. I just saw a poster the other day. It was a first grade teacher. It was a sign, and it was a little kid saying, my teacher believed I was smarter than I was, and so now I am.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's what a great editor does as well, like a great teacher. Jim Warren is his name, a former features editor at the Tribune. And he said, just go take your time. Don't worry about it. At that time, I was a book critic. So that was my job, was being book critic. I would go over there on the weekends or after work. I mean, it was done mostly on my own time. As you know, those are the kinds of jobs where you don't punch a time clock. You just go and do it. Started talking to people. And I very quickly realized that the story I wanted to tell, and again, it was only with having a great editor behind me I was able to do this, was how each of those people came to be there. The model I used was Thornton Wilder's The Bridge of the San Luis Rey. How do we reckon with the randomness of fate? The people who died had all done exactly what you're supposed to do in a tornado. They went to the oldest building, a tavern. They went to the lowest part of the building in the basement. And then something no one could have anticipated, the building collapsed on top of them. But there were other people in the basement too. So whether you lived or you died was completely random.
Mm.
Be this person lived, that person died, the person next to them died, the next two people lived. So of the eight people that died in the basement of that tavern, it was completely random. And I thought, how in the world as human beings do we ever wrap our minds around that? So I was able to construct the story, a long three-part narrative story. And again, not thinking of how in the world is a newspaper going to deal with this? This is not what we do. This is an old story. This was a story that had happened some time ago. It ran, 4 or 5 months after the event. But I should have had more faith in our designers and our editors because they did a wonderful job of packaging it and making it clear what it was that we did. And again, we were able to deal with this overarching idea of how we deal with the randomness of fate, of these terrible catastrophes that come with no warning.
Well, I know it's been a few years ago, but congratulations on your Pulitzer.
Oh, thank you. And that's a great surprise, too. That's the thing about awards. I have to say, I always tell friends of mine, too, would be upset about not winning things. I talked with the E.L. Doctorow about this because he had been a finalist for the Pulitzer, but never won a Pulitzer Prize, which is like unthinkable that an E.L. Doctorow shouldn't have ever won a Pulitzer Prize, and many, many of his novels were worthy. But as he and I discussed that day in his kitchen on Long Island, you simply can't get wrapped up in it. Because I said, critics are critics. Everybody is entitled to their own view. And there is a kind of a timing that goes with things, and you simply can't let yourself get caught up in that. You do your work, and the world gets to make its verdict. But the world's verdict has nothing to do with the work. And that's a bit of wisdom that I've had to learn my way into as well. We all want more recognition for our work. I mean, I wouldn't be sitting here today taking up your time and taking up your listeners' time unless I believed that reading Last Ragged Breath was going to be meaningful to people and was going to change their life in some way, however small. I wouldn't be doing this. I'd be home with Edward, throwing a stick and having him fetch it, which he loves to do repeatedly. Wouldn't be doing it. But we do it because we believe in the work. Now, what happens at the other end, that's completely out of our hands. I'm sounding like a very mature, wise person, but again, it's taken me years to get here because I'm like everybody else. And so something like winning a Pulitzer is something you can't even really envision or count on. Or some stories are written. I mean, some newspapers, as you know, they go through and they write these pieces and they spend a lot of money and they say, we're going to win a Pulitzer. We're going to do all this. We're going to spend hundreds of thousands of dollars. And they do. And then the pieces don't win. My piece was done, as I said, evenings and weekends. The most the Tribune had to spend was the cost of my Diet Coke and little package of cheese crackers. That's generally what my expense accounts would be. So I've said dollar for dollar, this was the cheapest Pulitzer any newspaper ever had. And the outcome was completely up in the air. Who knew? Who knew this was going to happen? And a million times I wanted to quit, but I kept at it. And I think sometimes fiction writing is that way too, because walk in a bookstore, walk in a library, hundreds and hundreds of thousands of books, all of which are clamoring for your attention, clamoring for your $15 to buy the paperback. And yet, here we are saying to people, read this one. This will make a difference. It's really the height of effrontery and gall when you think of it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the New York Times is certainly jockeying for some Pulitzers. That series Ian Urbina wrote recently about the crime on the high seas.
Right. Well, they've got several, this year. They do. The big projects. And nothing against those. I said, I don't mean to sound like I'm denigrating them. I mean, heaven knows we need newspapers to do the big projects. That's where it needs to happen. I wish we had more newspapers doing those. So I don't mean to say that those aren't worthy just because, and I've never understood that criticism. People say, well, they just wrote that because they won a prize. Well, so what? So what? Good for them.
Yeah.
Whatever it takes, newspapers and journalists are able to shine the light in some dark places. And so good for them, whatever the motive might be.
Hmm. Julia Keller joins us. Her novel is Last Ragged Breath. I heard a rumor that you are fond of the work of Virginia Woolf. Is this true?
Oh, yes, indeed. I wrote my PhD dissertation at Ohio State on Virginia Woolf. But I should say, you know, I had a friend who came to me and her daughter was trying to read Virginia Woolf in high school. And she said, she needs to talk to you. She can't make heads or tails of it. And I said, oh, neither could I when I was in high school. Her work is one you have to live your way into. It's not what you read, it's when you read it. And I think sometimes we do a disservice in school when we have people read things at the wrong time. And I'm sure you've had this experience. You'll sit down and read a novel, and it's like nothing to you. It's this dense, impenetrable prose. It's this thicket of verbiage you couldn't hack through with a machete. And then you wait a year or so, or maybe 2 years, or maybe three. Then you go back to it, and it is splendid and lovely, and it has such resonance for you. And that's how it was for me in Virginia Woolf.
How long should I keep waiting for Finnegan's Wake to make sense?
You know what? You know what James Joyce always said? He said, it took me 7 years to write it, then by golly, it should take you 7 years to read it. So just embark now. And but no, Virginia Woolf is one of those. You know, I spent this summer kind of rereading some of her early works that are lesser known. They're wonderful. They're wonderful. I keep waiting. The BBC, this should be their next project. Make a miniseries of Night and Day, which was the second novel she wrote. It was A Voyage Out, then Night and Day. It is spectacularly good. And so wonderful to think that it lies there waiting for us. That's the great thing about books. They wait. They wait until we're ready.
What is it about her, about her writing, that you find so compelling?
I think it is she's the best I've ever seen at representing what it's like to think. Her characters think, and you're right there with them. I mean, there are, of course, the wonderful observations about the world in books like Mrs. Dalloway. You get that. But you also get that the act of thinking. You get, I mean, stream of consciousness is the phrase that's often applied to her work. But that's easy to talk about, but very hard to do and to make it compelling. Because most of the time, I think in most of our heads, it's really pretty much, I think John Updike had the great phrase once when he said, inside this woman's head, it was sort of like a bumblebee inside an empty jar, you know, just kind of going along, bumping against the sides. But when you've got thinking people doing this thinking, which is funny and sad and surprising and all these things, and she was able to render thought in an utterly captivating way.
Mm. We have seen so many changes in the world of publishing. I know you've been watching, you've been observing, and now you're very much a part of that as a novelist in the year 2015. Mm-hmm. What's your take on the scene these days?
You know, what surprised me was, because I, like everybody else, as a book critic, I kept hearing that ebooks were going to take over, that hardcover books, hard and paperback books, actual books, the real thing, were doomed. And it actually ends up, it's not true at all. It's not true intuitively. We all know from our feeling we're all going to have books. We love books. We love the covers of them. But more than that, even the sales figures bear that out. Ebooks and things like Kindles and Nooks and such, it's a rising tide lifts all boats. They have increased the number of readers. They haven't taken away from what we think of as traditional books, pen and ink books. So that's the good news. And as far as all this dire predictions about it's all going away and, you know, books are doomed, I think I read a great article in the London Guardian a couple of years ago, and he said, you know, people in publishing are like farmers. A farmer will say, oh, my gosh, all this rain, my fields are swamped, what am I going to do? And the next year it's like, oh, my gosh, this drought, what's going to happen? It's always something, but the reality is they get the crops in and it works okay. Publishers are great doomsayers, but there's a lot of money still being made in publishing. People still do read. They read with the same gusto and the same relish as ever, and we have shows like yours, you know, at NPR member stations. We have people wanting to talk about books. You know, I go places. Sometimes the audiences are small. Sometimes they're large. But wherever it is, people want to talk about books. They want to talk about books that have changed their lives. Nobody is indifferent. They don't come up and say, eh, I don't know, couldn't care one way or another. They don't say that about books.
People do want to talk about books. And here in a small town, I don't think a day goes by where someone doesn't come up to me and say, so Vic, have you read any good books lately?
Exactly. Everybody has an opinion about a book. You know, books, it just occurred to me when I was chatting on there. Books are like Donald Trump. Everybody has an opinion. You know, nobody is neutral. So books are the Donald Trump of our cultural landscape now, that you don't get by without forming an opinion.
That's funny you'd bring him up because we had him on the program.
Really?
Yes. Hardest interview I've ever had to book. I hate to use that term, but yeah, I had him on the program. He had a book out called Trump, The Art of the Comeback.
Right, okay.
And it took me about 30 phone calls to get his publicist to finally agree to an interview. And I had him on, and he was very polite. He was plain vanilla, no provocation.
Really?
Oh, totally. He was just totally nice. It was the most boring interview you ever heard in your life. So he can turn it on. And he can turn it off.
That's fascinating. I wouldn't have thought that. I thought you were going to say that, you know, he ended up turning up a table and poking your producer in the nose.
Just
nothing?
As pleasant as could be.
Really?
Yeah.
And as you say, boring. See, if he'd gone off on the bombast, it would have been better. If he would,
He was just enduring it. He was just putting up with it.
Yeah.
And
enduring it.
Donald Trump, I'm proud to say. And people would say, well, why would you want to interview him? But, you know, nobody says that now.
Exactly. Right. Nope. Nobody says. Who knows? You may have insured yourself a cabinet position with that.
You know, I think ambassador is more my style. Maybe ambassador to Luxembourg or Liechtenstein.
One of the smaller ones. Monaco.
Principality. San Marino.
I know where you're going.
I need to add some stamps to my collection. Well, it's really been great having you on the program.
Yes. No, I really enjoyed it. Really enjoyed it. And as I said, I hope people will give it a look. There are a lot of books out there and... who knows? You know, who knows what's going to be the one that changes your life? But I just know for sure that one will.
My guest has been Julia Keller, her new novel, Last Ragged Breath, with the prosecutor Belle Elkins trying to get to the bottom of this very strange crime. You heard about it in the Book Nook on WYSO, another page turner for the Book Nook. I'm Vic McCunis.